Well, good evening. We'll go ahead and get the meeting started. Welcome to the November 14th meeting of the Kitsap County Planning Commission. And we'll start off with introductions on our far left.
Jim Swenson, South Kitsap.
Aaron Murphy, North Kitsap.
Spencer Stegman, North Kitsap.
Tom Nevins, North Kitsap.
Joe Phillips, Central.
Karen Ann Gonzalez Harless, South Kitsap.
Robert Baglio, South Kitsap. Next item is the adoption of the agenda. And I believe the minutes are not ready, so we'll have to go ahead and postpone those. So other than that, is there a motion for the adoption of the agenda?
I'll second.
All those in favor? Okay. So this evening, we do have several public hearings. There are sign-up sheets in back, and I believe the one regarding item F, is that the one that actually has a little sheet above it? Is that correct? But if you have signed up, I guess just make sure that maybe you signed up to the right one. And I guess with that, are we going to get a briefing on the first one from Holly? And I guess before she starts, if there are any public input, come on up, state your name for the record, where you live, and I guess we'll probably give you 5 minutes to speak. Okay? Sorry, go ahead. No, after. Yes.
All right, good evening again for the record. My name is Holly Roberts. I'm a planner with the Kitsap County Department of Community Development, and I'm here this evening to present an open space application for the Kitsap Golf and Country Club. The subject property is located east of Chico Way Northwest and south of Erlands Point Road Northwest in central Kitsap County, Commissioner District Number 3. This property was previously designated as a public facility and therefore was being taxed at a reduced rate. During the 2016 comprehensive plan update, a map correction was completed by county staff that removed this property from the public facility designation and applied an underlying zoning of rural residential. This map correction and subsequent zoning designation significantly altered the annual tax assessment for the property. Because the property was being taxed at a reduced rate based on the public facility designation, Kitsap Golf and Country Club was unaware that the property was not included in the open space designation with the rest of the golf course. The applicant is currently requesting that the property be included in the current use open space designation to better reflect the current use of the property. RCW provides for certain properties to be taxed on their current use rather than their highest and best use. Current use open space classification may be applied to land that enhances recreational opportunities to the public, such as this property. This application has been found to be eligible for a 60% reduction to the land value, 50% coming from a minimum of 2 priority resources, and 10% for the appropriate public access. Properties qualifying for the current use open space designation must have at least 2 sensitive characteristics and/or resources. As you can see, this property has 3 high priority resources, 1 medium priority resource, and 1 low priority resource. Transferring to the open space program will reduce the applicant's taxes on this property from $681.06 to $272.42, resulting in a total tax shift of $408.64. It is rounded on the Excel spreadsheet above. Staff has received several general inquiries from the public after the required public notices were mailed out. However, no one expressed any concerns or any objections to the application. They were merely calling to find out what it was. Staff is recommending approval of this open space application as conditioned in the staff report dated October 6, 2017. And at this time, I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
So I guess with that, we'll open up the public hearing regarding this particular item. Is there anyone here that would like to speak to this issue? All right. With that, I guess we will close the public hearing. And it is the intention to go into deliberation and finding of facts, correct?
Correct. And we have a copy of the findings of facts for signature if the Planning Commission so chooses.
Tom?
Yes, I will move that the Planning Commission recommend approval of this application.
I'll second that.
Any discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor? Unanimous. Okay.
Thank you.
That was quick. All right. So the next item, I believe Liz Williams is going to give us a briefing on before we get into the public hearing.
Thank you. All right. The Department of Community Development is proposing a batch of 33 items, which will amend various titles of Kitsap County Code. Over time, it becomes necessary to amend Kitsap County Code to reduce confusion and clarify existing language, update references to other codes, eliminate redundant and inconsistent language, and codify director's interpretation. This item was introduced by the department during the work study with the Planning Commission on October 17th. The department would like to mention that the Planning Commission will deliberate on the proposal at their next meeting, which is scheduled for November 21st. Because our online public comment period has been extended through midnight this evening. So we'd like to allow for some additional public comment on this item. We'll begin with a brief summary to kind of encapsulate or provide a summary of what the proposal is this evening. In your packet, you received a summary of the proposed batch of 33 code amendments, which was found in Attachment A. The proposed code amendments in track change format can be found in Attachment B. The proposed amendments impact Title 12, which is the stormwater drainage requirements for the county, Title 16, which is land use, division, and development, Title 17, which is zoning, and Title 21, which is land use development procedures. The proposed amendments have been categorized based on the following. Seven items deal with simplification of code. An example of this can be found in the summary table, which is ID 1, which changes the permit duration for stormwater drainage permits from 360 days to 365. This is intended to provide a little bit more ease for our user in terms of the time frame for permits. Efficiency and effectiveness relate to one item in the summary table, which is ID 5, and that is revising the definition of junk motor vehicles to be consistent with the health district. Again, just ensuring that we're looking at that particular item the same way. Internal code consistency is the bulk of the proposed changes this evening. So an example would be ID 8. That is reformatting the zoning use table to be consistent with the land use designations within the comp plan. So just making sure that the way that we are looking at the different uses and the zoning designations is consistent across all titles in the code. Clarification of code is another large reason for the changes that you are seeing presented by the department. An example of this would be found in ID 32, which is removing the reference to performance-based development for the Transfer Development Rights Program, because that does apply to all rezone requests that involve intensification of use. And then the final category of proposed changes includes irrelevant code requirements or removing redundancy. So there's three items that relate to that. An example would be ID 21. This relates to footnote 38 within the density, dimensions, and design table. And it discusses encroachments into the setbacks for architectural features. Well, if you look a little further down in the footnote section, you'll find that footnote 48 actually says the exact same thing. So the department is recommending to strike footnote 38 and revise it because it's redundant. The department has attended in terms of our outreach for this particular proposal. We've attended and met with various interested parties and will continue to do so throughout this public process as the proposal moves forward. A website was developed with information regarding the Kitsap County Code updates. And an online public comment form has been made available since October 19th. And we also did some public outreach through notification using GovDelivery and notified approximately 8,500 individuals through that service. And 1,200 individuals were notified via Nextdoor, which is another online tool that the county uses. So as a reminder, this evening the Planning Commission will receive public comment from those that would like to comment on the proposed batch of 33 development code amendments. Moving forward, like I mentioned, the online public comment form will be closed at midnight this evening, and all written comments received will be presented to you for your deliberations then on November 21st. We do anticipate then that you'll take action on this proposal at that meeting. So you'll also receive some findings of facts within your packet, which can be further amended as you deliberate on this particular proposal. So with that, I'll take any questions and then turn it back to you for public or for the public hearing.
Any questions?
Has there been a lot of online comments?
We have received, related to this particular proposal, 2 to 3 public comments that we will be sharing with you. There have been other comments received for additional requests for code amendments that have been added to the long kind of list of 200 plus code ideas that we have right now for the department.
Anything else, Joe? No? Okay, so I guess with that, we'll go ahead and open up the public meeting. I know there are a couple of people maybe just walked in, so there is a sign-up sheet in back still. Is it still there? Okay. So if you do want to speak on this item, if you would, sign up on that. And once again, when you come up, if you would, state your name and where you live for the record. And since there aren't many folks here, once again, we'll give you 5 minutes. It can be general. What's that? Oh, yeah, no, that's fine. You can actually, not that many folks here, so just raise your hand and you come up afterwards. Zero? Okay. Would you like to speak regarding this?
Yeah, I would.
Okay.
So I'm Kevin Tisdall. I live in Chico. Sorry. Kevin Tisdall, and I live in Chico. So I'm a third-generation resident in Kitsap County. So the growth and the pace of growth sort of looks to me like we're trying to match King County. And in literature I read, it even says in the literature, basically density to accommodate King County. I work for the city of Seattle. So I can't, myself, I didn't feel like I had enough time to process this change, or the 33 change proposals, whatever they are. And I have a hard time navigating the website to get the information and to clarify what I'm reading. So I'm just saying, I think, can we take more time? Is there a way to do that, to push this out a little bit further? I don't think it's enough time for people that are working every day to look at this, digest it, and even some of them, you know, have the aptitude to understand what some of these changes are. To me, it looks like, or sounds like, that it's allowing for an accelerated permit process or something. So, like I said, for me, I didn't even have enough time to digest it myself. And this is what I do all day,
mm-hmm.
Seattle Public Utilities. So, so I myself didn't have enough time to go over it. That's kind of why I said, okay, well, I'll jump over there and show up and see. Just get some clarification for myself. So what I'm saying is, can we have more time? Is that something that we could look at?
Yeah, we can certainly talk to staff.
That's all I had to say.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
If it's relevant.
So I think that was the only person that signed up, correct? Anybody else? Okay. With that, I guess we'll currently close that public hearing. Staff, do you want to, I guess, address the comments of the gentleman as far as timing-wise?
I would be happy to follow up with this gentleman to give him a little more information on this particular proposal, and then I'd also like to remind the Planning Commission that this is the first stage of the public process, and so this will also go before the Board of County Commissioners, and there will be a second public hearing at that time as well,
mm-hmm.
prior to any recommendations being made or changes being made.
Okay. Thank you. So I guess the next item on the agenda is the public hearing regarding code amendments referred to as the Batch of Three. And Darren Gurney, if you would.
While Darren's getting set up, can I ask a question on in the summary document about item number 23, which is footnote for density, dimension, and design tables, number footnote 46. My question is with regard to point A, porches shall be at least 40% open on each of two sides. My concern would be that anywhere that that location is 30 inches above finished grade, you are required to put a guardrail on a porch. So that could be contradictory to it. To itself elsewhere, just depending on the topography.
Okay. I can speak to this particular item was brought in as an administrative update because we felt that the language originally was very unclear in terms of the front yard setback. So that was the actual reasoning behind the change coming through. The requirements are actually from the Keyport sub-area planning process, and that came directly out of that community planning process for what they wanted to see for their particular community. So we can definitely take a look at, in the future, through another public process with that community group to see if there would be some other alternatives that they would be open to for that particular requirement.
So that footnote is only happening in the Keyport sub-area plan?
Particular, if you look at the use table, the only part that, or the only district, zoning district, that that footnote applies is in the Keyport Village Center zone.
Okay. Well, just keep in mind internally that that's, you know, in conflict with building safety.
Sure.
Should topography come into play in that scenario?
Right. Thank you.
Working a moment ago, huh?
I did break it.
There we go.
Okay. Thank you. Well, good evening, commissioners. Darren Gurney with Kitsap County. I'm here to present the batch of three code amendments this evening. And initially hadn't prepared a presentation, but felt like it was probably the best way to just have it on the screen and have a little summary. So the batch of three amendments, as identified in the staff report and the two attachments, there are there's a table of summary of changes and detailed line by line with red lines in your packets. The topics include short-term rentals, identified in your staff report as vacation rentals and bed and breakfasts. They also include maximum lot size in urban growth areas and the paved parking areas in urban growth areas. And we met with you on October 17th with those other code amendments, the 33 you just reviewed. And this project is actually taking a slightly different trajectory in that we are recommending that we keep the public comment period open for this hearing until November 30th to allow for more time for public feedback. And this is the start of our public process, and we expect to receive public feedback and to be responsive to that. With that said, for tonight, again, this is for the public hearing and to hear our comments from our community. To go into detail, short-term rentals, again, vacation rentals or bed and breakfasts, why we are amending the code. To begin, it is technically a commercial use within residential areas. This has potential impacts to neighbors. We have received complaints about noise issues, traffic issues, parking. Other jurisdictions have identified speeding, water issues, and septic. The difficulty with that is that we did not have a permit in the system that was necessary for vacation rentals prior to 2016. And our complaint system does not allow us to track it to a vacation rental per se. So that's where our difficulty lies in providing specific complaints that are attached to a vacation rental. With that, we also identify that there is a need for neighbors to be able to contact the owners of these vacation rentals for potential emergencies. So it's not just for a complaint basis. If there's, for some reason, a fire that is occurring or some necessity to contact that property owner, we also want to take that into account. And finally, for the building health and safety component of the vacation rental, that is another aspect we are looking at for amending the code. The existing code is for a vacation rental or bed and breakfast, as adopted in 2016. 1 to 4 rooms requires an administrative conditional use permit. 5 rooms or more requires the conditional use permit, which includes a hearing examiner decision. What is proposed before you today is that not just the new uses, but the existing and previously established uses will have to get this permit. However, with that being said, after additional analysis and feedback we've received, we do anticipate that we are going to receive feedback, and we anticipate developing alternatives through the public process, such as instead of an administrative conditional use permit, going to maybe a registration that has conditions with that to reduce that regulation on those items, but still have the same impact and goal achieved. The time for this is now. We actually, with the adoption in 2016, we have not received a single permit for vacation rentals. It is the existing and previously established uses that are having the impacts in our unincorporated areas.
If I recall correctly, at our last meeting, Mr. Baglio asked for some clarification about where the complaints were coming from, just trying to figure out the difference between a two-bedroom Airbnb, or are we talking about a unregistered wedding for 500 people on a farm happening every weekend? Are there 3 properties that have a problem, or are we finding hundreds?
And that is what I'm trying to convey, is that we cannot attach the complaints specifically to a vacation rental. That is more of an anecdotal piece to this, is that we can't attach it to a vacation rental because we don't know where they are. We can't actually define that within our current system of complaints. So we did hear that last time. That is something that we plan on trying to get more information about, but it has been very difficult to isolate it only to that use.
Well, I guess if I might add to that, it just seems odd if we're going to make a code amendment and start addressing this due to specific comments about complaints, yet you can't tell us where these complaints come from or that they're even tied to vacation rentals. So my question is, why are we even having this conversation here today? So, I mean, there has to be something tangible you need to bring to us that gives us a reason for us to implement the changes you're proposing. So, right. I mean, someone has to be complaining somewhere, and someone has to realize that it's something that appears to be a vacation rental by owner. Otherwise, like I said, I really don't see why we're having a public hearing and looking at making these changes then.
Well, again, it is also an issue of a commercial use in rural areas by the definition of vacation rentals. So it's not just those complaints that are driving this change. That is one of the aspects.
Well, I guess once you referenced that, you know, that's kind of what's bringing this on, is that you've been receiving a number of complaints. And so, you know, whether the complaints are because it's a commercial use or, I mean, it has to be originating somewhere. And so I guess it just seems like we're getting a little bit on semantics here, and it'd be nice to know really what's going on and where the complaints are coming from. Because if it's one location, then I think, you know, it makes a bit of a difference.
If I can interject, just to point out, this is a public hearing portion.
I do understand, but there has been several requests made, and the public's here. It seems like it would be something that would be good for them to know. And it's, like I said, it is the third time we've met and we've made that request. And I guess every time we get the same information. So I understand you're not on trial, but it's just one of those things we've been asking for. So.
Just one thing I'm not quite sure I understand. How do you establish an existing Airbnb or what? How are you going to determine that a vacation rental exists prior to the code?
Did you want
to take that one?
Okay. Part of that is going to be on when we establish the fact that it is a permit that is needed or a registration that is needed for continued operation. That when we receive a complaint about a location, we anticipate that being one way. We also have looked up on general websites to identify where some of these locations are, but that's where the nexus between the two, we have a little difficulty there.
Dave Ward, Department of Community Development. I just wanted to respond in part to the chair's question. We have received a handful of complaints that have been tied to vacation rentals. And that it is just that. It is a handful of complaints. It's not a big onslaught. Putting a number on how many of those complaints, as Darren said, has been difficult. We've reached out to the Sheriff's Department to see if they are tracking how many of their nuisance complaints are attached to vacation rentals or other similar facilities. They don't track it that way. We look to our own code enforcement staff. They don't track it that way. So while complaints are definitely coming in for nuisances, for parking issues, for noise issues, things like that, tying those complaints specifically to vacation rentals is right now we just don't have the data connecting correctly to be able to track that. That said, we know that some of them are tied to that. This is in a sense trying to keep ahead of that. We've looked to other jurisdictions to see how they are managing it, and in some jurisdictions this is a big deal. In others, it's less so. But we're trying to figure out how we can quantify it. It's just been very difficult. Part of the reason why it's difficult is because we actually, for looking back prior to 2016, we have no way of even identifying where these facilities are located and who's running them. So the intent is not as much to require a heavy-handed permit of retroactively of all existing vacation rentals. The intent of this is to just get those services into the system so we can begin to understand what's going on a little bit better. Yeah.
Just for public reminder, can you tell us the cost of an ACUP and a CUP, generally speaking, for something like this?
I don't know the exact cost off the top of my head, but the ACUP is in the ballpark of $5,000. The CUP is in the ballpark of $8,000. Is that correct? That's one of the reasons why, on further reflection, we're looking at this and saying we want to back away from that. Instead, what we're looking at is a self-registration process now. We're still exploring what our options are for this, but we're looking at like an online self-registration with a questionnaire that asks about how many rooms are in the facility, how many parking spaces do you have, that sort of thing. That would be a much, much smaller fee that would be associated with that. And the only reason for the fee is because then it would get put into our SmartGov system so we can actually track these uses.
Yeah, I have a lot of trouble thinking that anybody would self-identify before or after 2016 to cough up $8,000 for you. If they're not getting noise complaints.
That's exactly why we're rethinking this and looking at something that is less heavy-handed than that.
Okay, so enough beating you up. Should we open up the public hearing? Unless you have...
I have a couple of... The right, other two items okay. Still have some pieces here. So, the other two items, one of which is the maximum lot size exemptions. I'm not sure exactly who was here in 2016. My memory is not serving me best right now for that. However, 2016, we established a maximum lot size, which also required a subdivision for vacant parcels over 18,000 square feet. We are amending based on the fact that we want to promote housing type flexibility. We also want to remove the need for creating a reasonable use exemption. So in essence, we're meeting the minimum density standards through a single structure, not having to subdivide, and we are not requiring that somebody subdivide and create a critical area that they can then develop through reasonable exemption. So with those, the proposed revisions is if you meet the minimum density, you do not have to subdivide. And instead of gross developable area, it's net developable area to determine that threshold. Paved parking areas.
Yes, and this particular piece applies to lots that are on register presently and not lots that are created in the future?
Lots created in the future for the urban low residential and right. The urban cluster would have to meet the maximum lot size of 9,000, which would accomplish what that was intended to do in the first place. Paved parking areas, why we're amending, there's a possibility for misinterpretation that allows for gravel to be used in parking areas. Vehicle maneuvers can actually create locations where gravel is displaced, creating uneven surfaces, which are possible tripping hazards. You have stormwater possible implications there. So the existing code reads durable and dustless. We are proposing a change to paved. And this also includes you are allowed to use porous concrete, pavers, as long as it is a paved surface. So with that, as I mentioned, we'd like to have the Planning Commission conduct a public hearing and extend public comment period until November 30th.
So just for clarification on the extension of the public comment period, is that just written comments? Or is there going to be another hearing in front of the Planning Commission?
That was for written comments. Okay. We had not scheduled a second hearing at this time.
Aaron?
In reference to you quoting the word paved, where is the language that clarifies that pervious surfaces are acceptable as pavement?
I can provide that during your deliberations. Yeah. Okay.
I have one question. Are you going to be exempting the rentals from the ADA compliance?
Exempting rentals from ADA?
Right. Ramps, bathrooms for disabled people. How is that going to, I mean, I think if we're going to put this in the code, we need to be clear. Are they exempt or are they not exempt? Because I think that'll be an issue.
That will be something that we have to consider. If we go through a conditional use permit, that is typically something that would be covered in a conditional use permit setting. However, if we're going through registration with prescribed conditions, that would be something we would have to consider during code development.
Okay, so there is a possibility you would exempt from ADA?
I wouldn't be able to answer that right now.
Okay. Would that be something you could answer by next time? I would assume so.
Okay. I have taken note.
Okay.
To ask.
Thanks.
Any further questions?
I don't think so. Okay, so with that, we'll take public testimony. Is the sheet still back there? Here. So once again, we'll give you 5 minutes, and if you would, come up and state your name and where you live for the record. First person, Jackie Lewis.
I'm Jackie Lewis. I live in Keyport. I own the Grandview Gardens Bed and Breakfast. I think that they need to understand there's a vast difference between a regular bed and breakfast and a vacation rental by owner or an Airbnb or any of those. A regular bed and breakfast has concern for their area. I had a young man call who wanted to hold his 21st birthday in my home. It's my home. It's a bed and breakfast. I live there. I turned him down. There are other things like that that happen. And in a bed and breakfast, which is your home and you're living there, that's a whole different thing than an Airbnb because there could be nobody around for an Airbnb. So there's a real distinct difference. I belong to the Washington Bed and Breakfast Guild. We have requirements, and when I opened my bed and breakfast, I had to have an administrative conditional use permit. I had to have health district permits. I have to maintain health licenses for food and beverage operation. There's a fire marshal inspection here. I had to prove stuff about sewer and water. And I mean, it took me almost a year to get my permit for my bed and breakfast in 2009. Now you're saying in here that even previously established short-term rentals have to do this all again when I've already got all these? I don't, and in 7 years of operation, I've never had a complaint. And the only public comment, because I had to have a public thing where the public could come comment, was, will you guys get done doing this? Because I got people waiting to stay there. And I have never had a complaint. I think you're missing the boat, though. As a legal bed and breakfast, I pay taxes. I pay sales taxes. I pay B&O taxes. And I pay lodging taxes. I don't know of any Airbnbs that are doing that. I also know that Airbnbs aren't expected for safety or health. And as a bed and breakfast owner, I think you should be doing something, but it should be to the Airbnbs and the vacation rentals by owners. I know of three other bed and breakfasts in the county that I'm familiar with. They have health permits. They have all the stuff they need to be a legal, legitimate business and pay their state and county taxes. Airbnbs and those are avoiding all that. Airbnbs trying to, New York City is one particular place that's had a real problem with them because they call them alternative hotel sites. And so Airbnb is starting to respond by, if you tell them your tax rate, they'll collect the tax from the client, or the person staying. And so I've done that, but I've also, until they put that in place, I list on Airbnb. I get 4 or 5 a year because Airbnbs are looking for budgets. I'm not a budget rental place. So I've paid my taxes up to that point, but they are starting to respond by making sure that you tell them your tax rate so Airbnb will pay the county. But of a couple of Airbnbs I know of, none of them have bothered to tell anybody. So the county and the state are missing out on a lot of taxes. I think that's the more important point right now. But anyway, I do seriously object to the previously established bed and breakfast because we've gone through all that already, and I don't want to go through it all again, especially for $5,000. Thank you.
Thank you. So maybe clarification. It's not your intention to have them go through this again, correct? Bed and breakfasts that are...
That is correct. Previously established permitted uses would not have to go through that permit process again.
Okay. So. Okay, thank you. Yes?
Aaron? Yeah. Are we... Is this proposal possibly going to cross-thread some of those regulations?
Are the bed and breakfast, you know, they're following regulations. Now we're proposing a new set of regulations. Is it possible we're going to wind up cross-threading?
Cross-threading in what way?
Well,
contradicting previous conditions?
I've listened to testimony here, and I'm thinking, okay, yeah, health is involved, mm-hmm. safety is involved. We've got quite a bit. It sounds to me... You're proposing that we, you know, rein this all in under one, and I'm wondering if that's the correct way to go about it.
In terms of, so currently, the new use requires that conditional use permit right now,
mm-hmm.
or the administrative. So it wouldn't be contradicting that by just requiring a previously established non-permitted use to get that permit. So that wouldn't contradict. The tricky part would be if we're going to suggest a different form of permission, then we'd have to make sure and be consistent.
Okay. So. Just thought.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Next person on the list, Mark Isis.
Mark Isis, I live in the North End. I work in the Central End in engineering. It seems like these three proposals are kind of working in a vacuum. With the B&B deal, if you go back to the zoning code from 1995, the B&Bs have been in there. They've had to do ACUPs. They've had to go through the process. The county should be able to come up with a list of who's gone through the process, not make them have to go back through it again, and not give a special permit to somebody else that does the same thing. So if somebody's been doing this illegally, they shouldn't get some special credit that these other individuals have gone through and had to go through this code for all these years. And the county should be able to find these. Because, I mean, there's more information on that commission about county government than I think than what they put into their effort here. As far as the maximum lot size, that went into effect this last year. There's a pile of unsuspected homeowners, not homeowners, but property owners that bought property in Kitsap County in a UGA. They have no idea what zoning is. They bought a vacant piece of property. And I don't know how many this affects. The county, again, should be able to tell us, okay, how many vacant lots are there in the UL zone that this maximum lot size affects? Because if you had bought a half-acre piece or a one-acre piece in a UL zone and thought someday you'd build a house, and so then you come to the county a year later or 5 years later, and they go, oh, I'm sorry, you'll have to subdivide it into 25 lots in order to build your one house. It just doesn't sound right. So I don't, you know, and then they talk about an 18,000 square foot maximum. Well, how does that deal with septic? Because if you're not subdividing, you don't have to hook up to sewer for one single family. So it just seems like, you know they have a problem, but I don't think they've done the research that they talk about that they need to do for these amendments. And then we get to this paving issue. And, you know, they're taking a section of the parking code, which covers every zone in Kitsap County. When you need parking, you go to that section. So by changing it to, say, UGA, they're going to come back to you here in a year and go, well, guy, you know, we had this unintended consequence because we don't have a standard now for parking surfaces in rural commercial or rural industrial because we changed it all to UGAs. I went back through the zoning code, and back in 1983, it said all-weather surfaces for parking. In 1995 is when the current verbiage that's in your zoning code today started and has not changed since then. And they say that the intent is that everything should be paved and that's how, what they've always done. But if you look around, there's things like the fairgrounds where it made sense. You got a big parking lot, put in grasscrete. Look at the gravel parking lots. When you go to the fair, where do you pay $4 for it to park? On a gravel parking lot. When you get to, you've got industrial zones in your UGAs. So if you're going to put a contractor storage yard in an industrial zone, so you're going to pave the parking lots? Does that really make sense? If you're doing boat storage, do you need pavement? Or is gravel or an all-weather, you know, what the statement says today, durable surface, isn't that okay? It's the utilities. When you put in a water reservoir, you got to have two parking stalls, you know, for the guys that work on it. Does that really need pavement? Go to Ross Field where the Peewees play. Do they need pavement down there? They seem to do okay all summer long, you know. I don't think it was the intent ever for everything to just point blank period be paved. It just doesn't seem like it passes the smell test. So I guess I'd ask you to ask them a few more questions, you know, especially on this maximum lot size. They've gone around and they figured out who in the commercial zones all have over one UGA for the stormwater so that they can get a couple more ERUs and get more stormwater. Well, with that same technology, they should be able to say, okay, here are all the lots that are in our urban low that we're affecting. You can't tell me that you know whether it's a reasonable measure or not if you don't know how many lots you've affected. And then you don't tell the individual that you're affecting them. They have to come and find out on their own, because most of the public isn't as educated as planning commissions and that type of thing. So I think there needs to be just a little bit more thought process through the whole thing. My two cents.
Comments? Thank you. Next on the list, Annalie Baglio. I haven't influenced her in any way, shape, or form. Just make this very clear.
Are you abstaining at this point?
Hi, I'm Annalie Baglio, and I sell real estate here in town. I have a lot of clients that have been investing in VRBOs and Airbnbs. I can't speak to Airbnbs. I can only speak to the VRBOs because we've used them, and I also have clients that have them. And my understanding from what I have read in their contracts, I mean, there's taxes, VRBOs, not Airbnbs. There are taxes they pay. There are insurances they have to have. There are safety mechanisms that they have to put in place if they're on the VRBO website. So I know that some of these things are addressed already. I guess I'm just curious if there was a lot of outreach to the individuals that already own the VRBOs and the Airbnbs for that matter. I mean, has there been discussions with these stakeholders at all? I think that would be beneficial. And the complaints, I know it wasn't just him. I've spoken to a few folks where they were curious because I said, well, there's been complaints. The two people, and again, this is just two folks that I know that are VRBO individuals that have houses, they asked me what kind of complaints were they getting, because they have rules and regulations in place for each of their places that they rent out. That's really the bulk of what I have to say about this, but I think that reaching out to the stakeholders, because so many of the folks that I've spoken to just didn't know that this was coming about. That's all.
Comments?
Well, and I don't know if you don't mind, I think that there's a big difference, as the first lady alluded to, between being a 6 or 8 bedroom, you know, B&B, and versus, I guess I'd have to almost argue, why are we discussing being in the business of regulating house rentals, right? I rent a house on a contract, multiple houses for 365 days a year, and then it goes to a 30-day month by month if they stay in my home, right? Mm-hmm. Why do you care, county, if I rent 3 days at a time because I have a waterfront view and I can pencil my mortgage on day 8, or if I need to rent it 30 days a month to renters like every one of us that owns an extra house? Are we really in the business, right? Doesn't Airbnb or VRBO have state-by-state regulation requirements that are none of our business? And why are we even discussing how to collect? It's fine, I think, if you want to have some registry, as they spoke to earlier, for things like consistent county nuisance or whatever it is, sound or storm, or, you know, the septic overflows every other week, or great, that is our business. Regulating how we collect taxes on a rental property, you may as well ask the question of every one of us that owns a rental house, regardless of how many days it gets rented at a time.
Tom?
I'd just like to say that comments from planning commissioners would be more appropriate after November 30th, when we actually hold our deliberation, so we can kind of calm that down a little bit.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's see, the last name on the list, Ken Erickson.
How you doing? I'm Ken Erickson. I live in Hansville, Washington. I have a VRBO, so I can address a lot of your questions. I've been in real estate for 30 years. I rented VRBOs in Florida and other places. And I want to take this sort of step by step. It's raining out today. The winds are blowing. There's not a lot of VRBOs renting right now. This is just 3 months a year. You know, you might get some in June, but normally it's July and August and September. People come up, the families come up from Texas, they need somewhere to stay. Okay, you have a VRBO. Me and my other fellow VRBOers in the north part of Hansville area, we know each other, we have a license, we collect those taxes, we pay them every year, we do all of that. Yes, Airbnb now sends that to the state and collects it. The others don't, but we all fill out our forms and all that. We have a business license. I've rented real estate for years. It's in a sense similar to that, but you're in a smaller scale. There's not a lot of money in it. The unincorporated areas don't have the problem with parking or this or that that you would have in the middle of Bremerton or somewhere else, where you could see if you had four cars because they're coming for, you know, their son-in-law's wedding or whatever is going on. You know, the cars or something might be a thing. But for us, parking's no problem. Us VRBO owners know each other, you know, because so-and-so's busy this weekend. How do you do? You know, you got any room? And those people have family reunions, and they know us and say, well, we want to book here. If there was a complaint at my place, everybody would know who owns it because it's a property and you look up who the owner is. It's as simple as that. You know, we all meet our, you know, septic stuff and all that. We have yearly maintenance, everything with the health department, and everything's done. When you fill out the form, they ask you, do you have stairs? So everything is above board and all that, and any complaints then would from the people renting it would go to the Airbnb site, you know, so that the complaints are worked out. And then we have the ratings, and everybody likes to get a reply back to say I had a wonderful time and all that. So we all work for that. And like I said, we're not renting this month because why? It's not summer. So it's very few. You don't rent out all year long, you know. I've rented houses before and all that, and you have more complaints from your renters, you know, or we complain about our renters not paying us or this or that. So these other sites are all on the web. You can see. So if you had 30 VRBOs in downtown Bremerton, it pops right up. Same with Airbnb or anything. We looked at doing a bed and breakfast. We looked and saw the permitting requirements needed, and we didn't feel we wanted to cook breakfast that many times and all that. And those conditional use permits are quite expensive. Takes a long time. And the people we get aren't as interested in a bed and breakfast. See, there's two things. It's just you don't need the bed and breakfast. They're good for what they do, and if people like that. But otherwise, they just want the family members together, and we'll get up when we want, start the coffee when we want. And a lot of them don't cook breakfast because they don't, you know, they're not into that. And like I said, I've stayed at VRBOs in Florida, and my family stayed at them in Oregon, California, you know, and it's nice to just kick back something a little bigger than a motel room somewhere. And in Kitsap County, the motel rooms are pretty packed in the summer. And that's not as conducive to the VRBO atmosphere, especially in the unincorporated areas. So if Bremerton or something complains about, well, they had six cars over there, it's not like Daytona Beach, because the people who rent facilities in Florida know they have to have somebody that's 25 years or older do the renting, so you don't have the spring breakers come down. And that's what we know, too, because we're all experienced in it. Let me just look at my list here to see anything else. Yeah, I think that's about it. And if you know real estate, you know, it was sort of nice to be able to rent a house for just a short time versus, you know, have to get three motel rooms together. Of course, they're not together. There's two down the hall and all that. And we've stayed in them here, and, you know, you just don't want to be by the ice machine or the elevator. Any questions?
I do. Do you have an occupancy limit for your home?
Sure. Oh, absolutely.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
You just put it on the thing. It's, you know, X amount of people, and that's it.
Okay. And is...
we don't let them sleep on the floor. We don't let them come and have extra people and, you know, all this kind of 14 people hang out, because there's certain restrictions. You don't want your house trashed.
Right.
And the VRBOers are usually older, you know, and more conducive to staying at VRBOs. And so they're respectful of your furnishings and everything like that. Okay. So, yeah, we don't let them.
Is there like a maximum vehicles allowed in your parking lot, or is there enough room?
We're on 5 acres.
Okay.
So, but with the, again, we don't have 14 people in 7 vehicles. That equation doesn't work out. You know, they might have 3 kids and husband, wife, and grandma. You know what I mean? So that's about it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Anything else?
Jim?
Sure. VRBO, that's an acronym for what?
Vacation Rental by Owner. Okay. It's a website.
And that's an organization.
Yes, sure it is. National, Europe, doesn't matter where. Yeah. It's like Airbnb, but they've been in business longer, and they do things a little different. So Airbnb, if people have heard about it, it was just a little different the way they do it.
Thank you.
But either way, you pay fees to them. You know what I mean? It's like if we got to go to the county for $5,000 to $8,000. You're renting your house for 2 or 3 months. The equation doesn't work out. It really doesn't. You know, because the houses aren't that big to get that many people, and to try to, you know, get, you know, $800 a night or something, that just doesn't happen.
So obviously, to go ahead and utilize this, you have to be registered, like you said, in the National Registry. Airbnb, yes. As well as Vacation Rental by Owner.
That's right.
So obviously it really wouldn't be that difficult for anybody to go on site and say, gee, we're getting a complaint from this address. Are they a VRBO or are they an Airbnb? You can simply look on the website, do your homework, and say, yes, they are.
If you name the street, if it's Elm Street, all you do is look to see how many VRBOs are on Elm Street, and there's one, and that's the place. And if somebody on that street was complaining because it was 4th of July and the fireworks, which everybody can complain about, then it's that one on Elm Street because they already looked it up too. So
okay.
Just like if it was in my neighborhood with fireworks at midnight on 4th of July, you'd know.
Mm-hmm.
But from the property, it took 2 minutes to open up 2 websites and cross-reference.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thanks.
So that's the last of the names on the list. Since we are a small group, is there anyone else here that would like to go ahead and speak that has not spoken on this topic? Go ahead.
Sorry, I didn't sign up. So a big glaring thing that I saw about this, because I considered buying a house down the road from me on the water side to make it a Airbnb. I utilize those myself for vacations. Aaron, you were speaking what business does the county have? And here's what I see. It's a liability for the county. One, we're advocating for density. We're advocating for small cottages, for dwellings or additional dwellings. But at the same time, right now with Airbnbs, Anna pointed out, many of her clients are investors into homes, consuming homes here. Not only that, but you can get a loan for the down payment from Airbnb now for this home. So now you have wealthy investors that have the ability to buy several or many homes. And my buddy did end up buying this house down the road from me on Chico there, by the way. It's a conflict because we want to produce housing for people, but this does the very opposite. The availability of funding for investors across the water to come and consume many homes, and then the availability of down payments for that home and the agreement with the Airbnb, it illuminates more housing, right? I mean, we're consuming housing as a vacation spot, which I kind of, as I visualize Kitsap County, it's a great place to vacation. So I think there are more needs to be more like Leavenworth or a cruise ship even to stimulate our economy and help provide jobs here with our working class that we have here. But this, again, to me, is a conflict, and it opens the county to a potential liability, you know, because it is, like I said, directly a conflict. With the need for housing, it increases the cost of housing. You know, homes go up in price, and there's a kind of a monopoly. But anyways, that's my commentary on that.
Okay. Thank you. So I guess that concludes our public hearing. And once again, just a reminder, that's going to stay open at least through public comment submitted either online or in writing, correct, till the 30th. On these items? Okay. So I guess with that, we'll close that, and now we'll go to item G, administrative update, Mr. Jim Bulger.
Good evening, planning commissioners. A lot to think about, obviously, in the coming days, weeks ahead. I don't have much of an update. A couple of things that we've talked about in past meetings, we're going to be dedicating some more ample time to address them. Probably the main thing is the county has expanded its online permit system. This is in a move that you've heard about to go to electronic plan review and essentially go to a paperless system within the county on November 6th. Our fire permits went all online. We've been doing a number of trainings around the county. We've made offers for individual businesses who do a lot of business with the department that we will go to their place of business and train their staff to take advantage of this new online permitting system. And so far so good. And we'll be coming back, I believe, at the next meeting potentially to provide you with an online demonstration so that you can see it in action in terms of how folks would be submitting their permits online. Yes, sir.
Can I bring an example?
Can you bring an example
permit? To use the permitting process?
You can do it online right now if you have a fire permit that you're trying
to. I thought maybe you could show me.
We can show you.
Robert, bring in an application and have you get it over the counter form while we sit here.
We are going to give you the directions to the nearest copy center where you can scan your documents and submit them in the easy-to-use portal that we will demonstrate during the next meeting. So that's the big thing. The other thing is coming up in early December, the department will be moving forward with its annual fee adjustment. Probably the biggest change, we took this to the board during a work session yesterday. The biggest change is going to be in the development land use, the Title 21 categories, where a lot of these fees are really based on you put down a deposit and it's based on the review time. Well, we've been doing this long enough, and with our electronic review tracking permitting system, internally, we can track the number of hours that go into the review, so we've got a long enough time series now that we can actually get pretty close to just going with a flat fee. So of the 71 Title 21 permits, we're going to move 17 of them initially into a flat fee. So no more put a deposit down, and then we'll either invoice you if it took longer or refund if it didn't take as long. You'll just come in with a flat fee, and we'll take a look and see how we're doing with some of those estimates. We feel like it's a more predictable system for our customers who get frustrated when we have to ask for more money for a longer review time. It also saves us quite a bit on just the administrative invoicing and refunding that we have to do. So that's one of the advantages of a better timekeeping system within the department. So I'm happy to field any questions. Yes, sir.
Did you say?
I thought I heard you say November 6th for going paperless. What was, I thought it was in
the end of the year. So it's kind of a soft launch. So we're taking different permit types and we're rolling them out and making them online submittal. We're making them available for online submittal. So the first batch was November 6th where all of our fire permits, so sprinkler systems and those kinds of permits, those are all online now that we're asking people to submit their forms either remotely from wherever they are or come in with the electronic versions of them. And as I say, we're doing a number of trainings. Those are on our website, but we're doing specialized trainings and we'll go into businesses, as I said before. And for the people that come in for kind of the one-off permits, they may never come back again. We will support those people within the office over a period of time. So we can do some scanning, but for most of the jurisdictions that we looked at, that it really seen some pretty good efficiencies by going paperless for a lot of reasons, not only storage space, but also time and things like that. They find that to take full advantage of it, you have to go completely paperless. You can't make exceptions here and there because then you kind of need dual infrastructure within the department to be able to deal with that.
Do you have plans to present it like KHBA, for example?
Yeah, we're going directly to the the stakeholder groups. We're going directly to them. We're doing specialized trainings for different industry sectors. So there was training for fire over the last couple of weeks. We do trainings right here. And as I said before, if anybody wants to have us come to their place of business, we'll send staff over there to demonstrate. Yeah, Karen.
So how do you coach the individual who's not part of that? They're just coming in for a regular permit for a deck or an addition, and they're doing it themselves.
Right. So we can help them in. I mean, we're not closing the doors to the department. We'll certainly still have permit techs who will be available to can walk them through it. I think you'll see in the demonstration that we'll have set up at the next meeting that it's pretty straightforward when you go to the web portal. I mean, probably the most complicated thing for people of my generation is just establishing the account for yourself. And once you have your account, everything else is pretty much kind of walks you through step by step in terms of what you have to upload. And,
well, how much time does it take if you had to walk someone through it for just they come in to submit their permit? What would it normally
I be? Don't know off the top of my head, but that would be a good question to ask the folks that come and do the demonstration for you. And you may get a sense of that as they do walk you through because it really is kind of a step-by-step-by-step process. I am definitely not a super user in this area, so the technical questions are pretty much exhausted me in terms of my information.
So I see you have, this is included in our packet.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know the context for which that was requested, but I'm happy to field any questions on that.
No, I just didn't know if there was something, you know, a purpose for it. Just
no, it was my understanding that there was a request at a past meeting, Amanda, if that's correct, that we would make that available.
Yeah, it was asked, I think it was Commissioner Murphy that asked to see 5 years, 2 years, the difference in permit revenue before and after the recession, that kind of thing. So we just put it out the last 10 years.
And I would just say that maybe that's as a revenue, that's what you're looking at, but permits are pretty much been flat. I mean, we're getting more complicated projects, higher value projects that are coming into the department, but the actual number of applications is staying kind of steady right now. More commercial.
I think
more
it's complex. The applications that are becoming more complicated.
Oh, come on.
So in the past, we'd kind of get a briefing on staff. Right now, there's a handful of openings. I know we have the building official, fire marshal, mm-hmm. which looks like those are being combined. And then there's also an assistant director position.
That's one position. So that's, okay. If you recall, Jeff Rowe, who went on to Pierce County to be the chief building official in Pierce County, that's effectively his position. So the department has two assistant director level positions. Most of my responsibility is under the kind of the planning, current planning and zoning and natural resources. And that position that's being advertised right now is really on the building and development side of the department and would also include the fire marshal and code compliance.
No, I just like I said, we used to kind of get briefed on that, just kind of interest, but might want to know.
Yeah, we also have a few other positions that are open. We have some term inspector positions that will run through 2019, and I believe it's 2019. And those are really to help us with some of the big projects that are going on right now, particularly in the Silverdale area with the school, Central Kitsap School District, and the development, redevelopment that they're doing with the high school, and then the hospital that's going in. And so we need to kind of amp up on our inspector staff. We also have one position that's a new position, but it's also anticipated to be kind of a successional planning because we have some staff that are kind of on the verge of retiring. And so this will give us a chance to do some cross training in the commercial area, which is a little more technical inspection skill set, so that we can make sure that we don't have any big gaps in our staffing capacity. And then we have an engineering one position, I believe, engineering one or two position that's currently posted as well.
Okay. Anything for the good of the order or other questions?
Oh, very good TV appearance there, addressing the Silverdale.
I prefer to close the bar by saying it's 2 o'clock, you don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. That was unfortunate. So, and my best stuff was on the cutting room floor.
Yeah. All right, well, with that, meeting adjourned. Oh, Jim, I'm sorry.
I just have a question. Now, it's my understanding that the record's been kept open until November 30th, but we have a meeting on November 21st, or do we?
Mm-hmm. I believe we do.
Okay. And what's going to be on the agenda then?
So the record for the three revisions, so the short-term vacation rental, the maximum lot size, and then the pavement, those three will keep the record open until the 30th, and your deliberations at your next meeting will be on the batch of the administrative updates, and that public record, that record will stay open till midnight tonight, and then that also, they'll be, the board, when they consider adoption, will also be accepting additional testimony at that time to make modifications.
Thank you.
So.
Okay. Joe?
Darren, I would make a recommendation that we kind of get it doesn't have to be real detailed, but a comparison of the VRBOs, the Airbnb, the bed and breakfasts, so we can kind of look at this and compare them and see what's being demanded on each group.
I just want to make sure and clarify which comparison you're looking for.
Well, right now, tonight, we talked about bed and breakfasts. We talked about the vacation rental, the VRBOs, and then the Airbnb, and I think there's some more cropping up. I know we talked about it at the last meeting at Campion.
Yes, we can do something.
That just so that we kind of know what are the regulations currently applied to those different groups, if any. I know the bed and breakfasts are, you know, highly regulated.
Yes.
So it'd be nice to know what these others, if they have any regulations at all.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
Anything else? Okay, meeting adjourned.